structures damaged or destroyed so far in the fires, but said about 30,000 residents were under evacuation orders and more than 13,000 structures were under threat. Ryan Adams is with California Wildfire Tracking.
These winds have produced gusts of up to 100 miles an hour, which is as strong as a hurricane here. This has produced many, many fires, getting up to even 3,000 acres.
I'm Scott Baba for Pacifica Radio.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features reflections on autonomy, direct democracy, and maroonage with Modibo Kedali. Part 1, Africa Now is next. Welcome to Sharm Wizum Tali. The music in the background is All Africa by Max Roach, and we play that remembering the legendary ancestor drummer, composer, musician's birthday, which is January 10. In his publication, Intimate Direct Democracy, Fort Massey, The Great Dismal Swamp, and The Human Quest for Freedom, Modibo Kedali aptly points out younger people are convinced that the nation-state is not offering them a future. Newer generations of researchers are now beginning to look for evidence of community and collectivity. A collectivity that lies in the very fabric of Africana forms of knowing and ways of being, fully articulated in the various forms of resistance found throughout the Americas expressed as Maroon communities. In defining, mapping, and attempting to find the most articulate application of democracy, Modibo Kedali presents an important intervention into the questions that move in and throughout discourses on democracy. Kedali engages interdependent themes such as Black autonomy, radical public and social history, intimate direct democracy, social intimacy, Black geographies, and radical ecology, while centering a Pan-Africanism that strengthens conceptual lens through which continuities in Africana social, political thought and resistance can be further identified. Kedali's perspective on Black autonomy grounded in social intimacy as being the operative mechanism for a functional democratic society is undoubtedly rooted in his own background. Kedali grew up in Riceboro, a Gullah-Geechee community on the Georgia coast, where he often points to African ways of being and forms of knowledge that were transmitted from generation to generation and deeply ingrained in his worldview throughout his early development. Today we listen to a portion of part one of our part series where we explore direct democracy, autonomy, maroonage, Black anarchism, and atheism with Modibo Kedali. Dr. Modibo Kedali is a social ecologist, academic, and lifelong radical activist within the civil rights, Black power, and Pan-Africanist movements, and the founding convener of the Autonomous Research Institute for Direct Democracy and Social Ecology. He is the author of Pan-African Social Ecology, Speeches, Conversations, and Essays, Internationalism, Pan-Africanism, and the Struggle of Social Classes, Intimate Direct Democracy, Fort Massey, The Great Dismal Swamp, and The Human Quest for Freedom, and a number of other articles. During the early and middle 1970s, Modibo Kedali was an active member of several radical organizations. In the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, he served as a member of the Central Staff and chair of the People's Action Committee in Highland Park, Michigan. In the International African Liberation Support Committee, Kedali was a founding member of the National Steering Committee. He chaired the Detroit Local Committee in 1972 and 1973, and then continued as a member of the Expanded International Steering Committee as a representative from Atlanta from 1973 to 1975. Within the 6th Pan-African Congress, he chaired the Southern Regional Organizing Committee from 1974 to 1975 and was also a member of both the North American Delegation and the North American Left Revolutionary Pan-African Caucus. We joined the conversation between Modibo Kadale and African Isles executive producer and co-host James Pope after he talks about his early education experiences. Here is the conversation.
So this is, I guess this is a very important question. You graduate from Morehouse, or you leave
Morehouse.
Yeah, you leave Morehouse. Let's pick up there. These experiences are definitely opening, right? There's opening and with every opening, there is also an opportunity to fill it with something, right? You know, so your consciousness is opening, you know, to a context of belief and searching for knowledge, direct democracy, anti-authority. You know, the anti, you know, hierarchical structure, spontaneity, organization, all of these things are moving.
Yeah, that's exactly what was happening.
You know, let's pick up as you are. This is a great foundation of your, you know, coming from your community, going to Morehouse. This is opening spaces, but then you leave Morehouse. Let's pick up there. You know, what happens in the context of leaving Morehouse and how it sets you on a trajectory to be involved with the League of Black Revolutionary Workers, to be involved with a lot of, you know, African liberation support movement. We'll talk about those things in sequence, but you leave Morehouse. What is happening at this particular
I graduated from Morehouse in three and a half years. I left in January of 1963. I was 19 years old, so I came home for a while. And I applied to graduate school. I got a degree in psychology and sociology. So I came down here and I was teaching as a substitute teacher until May. And I had written a letter to my aunt, the same aunt that we visited in the Bronx. She was, I think it had moved to Harlem by then. So I said I was going to come up there, but I was going to get a job on the waterfront in Atlantic City. So I caught the bus, went up there. Either the bus gonna go to Atlantic City from Philadelphia. I think they had a shuttle or something back and forth. And then another bus was gonna go to New York. So I called my aunt and she said, well, you can come on up to New York. Your cousin Joe is working in upstate New York and he can get a job up there as a counselor for a camp. So I decided not to go to Atlantic City and I went up to New York. And my cousin Joe was already up there. Joe later became president of Houston Tillerson College. He's dead now, but that's the same Joe, Joseph McMillan. Anyway, when I got up there, I spent one night. Joe said, come on up. So he gave me the direction. It was kind of weird because I went to Grand Central Station and caught a train. And the train went up to Pawling, New York. And then it started separating and going all kind of different ways. And there was one car coming down the street. And he was waiting for me at Wingdale, New York. So I got a job at the teen camp up there. And this was a religious, it wasn't religious, it was missionary, multi, you know, it was religious, but it was not, it wasn't specific to a denomination. So I got a job up there and I met some people, some of them from Puerto Rico, some of them from Cuba, because this, you know, the Cuban Revolution had consummated itself by then. And I met to the strange thing, because I remember you interviewed Abdul on one of your things. And Abdul had a roommate named Mario Agote. Mario Agote was working up at this camp that summer.
Oh, wow.
So I knew Mario, but I didn't know that was the same Mario that Abdul was talked to. So I became, they needed a lifeguard at the lake and a counselor. So I was, you know, They gave various breaks. I used to drive the bus down to Harlem to pick up the kids, and that was black and white and some of everybody. You know, I'm leaving the South, going up to New York and upstate New York, where all these people of different ethnic groups speaking different languages. And so that opened me up a little bit. That same summer, the world was different then, man. I hitchhiked through New England, and I wanted to go through Weird Beach because, see, I was a romantic, man. Peyton Place was the movie that was winning all the Academy Awards. And the Peyton Place, I did research, it really was Weird Beach, New Hampshire. And then a girlfriend of mine from Clark had gotten a job in one of them camps up there. So I hitchhiked up there and hitchhiked through Massachusetts and up to New Hampshire to a lake where she was working, you know. And one night, never forget this night, I spent the night in a laundromat in Manchester, New Hampshire. And I thought I was hallucinating because I was smelling cotton. So when I woke up the next morning, I was behind the machine. Washing machine, laundromat was open all night. So I got up and went outside and I saw these big factories there. And so I realized, I asked the people where the cotton come from. And did it come from the South? Where did you get this cotton from? They say it came from the South. It's always been coming from the South. So I'm having to hook all of this stuff up. And I realized that this was a textile manufacturing center. I didn't know. I learned it later, but I realized that. And then I hitchhiked back to the camp, and then I went down to Howard because I was in school at Howard that same year. And I met Dr. Hicks. This guy had just come back from doing some research and the Pavlovian Institute in the Soviet Union at the time. But he wasn't that political. He just believed in the research. And he believed in teaching and learning. And he was different. I mean, he became my friend and everything. We had some good times together. And he had a good sense of humor. And we just hit it off real good. And so I became his assistant. And then I realized what research really meant. You know, how experimentation really meant. And then after a year, I had to write a thesis. And I applied for some money from the Sci-Chi Honor Society. And I won the National Sci-Chi Research Prize in 1964, 65. I can't remember. I have to look through my stuff. You know, and then I went to Atlantic City to the conference, to the thing, and spoke at the convention. And, you know, I was a scholar then, you know. And then I was going to get my PhD at a couple of schools who gave, I think Indiana was the one that wanted me the most. I got these letters from the draft board.
And this is right after you're finishing your master's degree, right?
Yeah. Okay. I ran into the college bureaucracy because they wouldn't let me get my degree conferred in that June because my thesis was typed on the wrong kind of paper.
Mm. And this is at Howard.
Yes, Howard. Yeah, yeah, so I went to the graduate dean and I went in his office. I said, "Dean, look, these people finna draft me. I'm finna go to the war in Vietnam and probably get my head blown off. And you got a rule which says I can't get a degree because degree is typed on the wrong paper. And I can't get into no graduate school unless I have a degree." And you can imagine what the guy said. What do you think he said?
I think he said, "Tough luck."
Yeah, rules, the rules.
You know, I'm firmly in the HBCU system, you know, as a student, as a professor.
Same so Howard.
I
know,
yeah,
I forgot the guy's name, same Howard. So I applied. So I said, no, I gotta go to Plan B. So since I couldn't get a degree, I applied to Dalhousie University, some Canadian university. They said I could come up there. I didn't have to have the degree in hand. A degree or some kind of letter from somebody. So I went back, I applied, and I showed him that I had been admitted to one of the Canadian universities. I think it was Dalhousie. He said, well, I can't write you the letter because you don't have the degree. So I went, came back home. I'm seething, man. You know what I mean? So I go to Hinesville, that's the county seat of Liberty County. And this old segregationist lady who was over the draft board appointed by the county commissioners, which was still segregated. You know, black county commissioner like that. So I go to Atlanta and get my 1A. Well, the classification I had was 2S. Then I get the 1A, which means that they would call me up as soon as I got back or whatever. So I made plans to go to Canada. And so I left and went to Canada. Now, what was happening, my father and I were split. He couldn't understand that. His thing was, this is America. People have duties. I served in World War II. And he had said, my brother had gone to Vietnam. And then came back an alcoholic, really bad. But my father advised him to go to Vietnam because it was early in the war, and he figured the war got heavier than he'd already fulfill his obligation. So I looked at him, I said, man, you got to be out your mind. I said, look, I am not going to the war, period. I was jammed up in circumstances that brought all that to the head. And I was convinced that, number one, they know better than me. Our struggle is here, because I remember what Malcolm said, all that other stuff. And I said, no, I'm not going. He said, well, you're not no son of mine. I said, well, I guess I'm not. I packed up, you know, and left. But my mother said, wait a minute. Evans, that's my father's name. Evans, you can't send him away like that. And he said, you got to have some kind of commitment to your country. And I said, what country? What are you talking about? And so my mother said, just stay one more night. He'll be a different guy in the morning. I said, nah, I'm going. I grabbed my from down here, what I could salvage, and caught a Paul Wood truck to Savannah. Caught a train from Savannah going north. Picked up my apartment in D.C. and caught a flight to LaGuardia. Then I stopped in New York to old girlfriend of the house, spent the night there, flew out to Canada, flew out to Boston the next day, and there was another flight to Halifax, Nova Scotia. So that's the turning point there. That's the commitment there. And up there, I met Rocky Jones, who's dead now, but he was the founder of he was a SNCC type guy, but he was a Canadian, an Afro-Canadian. Then I met all kind of African-Canadians. They said that their parents were from the South. I said, wait a minute, what is going on here? Then I realized how little I knew and how much education I had, but how little I knew.
Let me ask you a question. So you're experiencing, and there's this innate rebelliousness against this order, but you're learning these experiences. You're learning through the research, again, because you've developed this notion of direct democracy, anarchism, black anarchism.
No, I'm not no anarchist yet, consciously, deliberately. I'm anti-authoritarian.
Right. Absolutely. Because we want to get there. And I think it's important, right. You know, because again, I think it's important for us to understand that what we're talking about is all of these experiences that really formulate you. But I'm also interested in how are you sharpening this in the context? And I'm assuming that once you go to Canada, there's a sharpening text that you're reading, people that you're engaging
okay,
that's, with.
That's, at Morehouse, I first got acquainted with Marx, but Marx was taught as as an atheist. Now, Lonnie Cross was some kind of communist. I didn't know what kind of communist he was, but he was an atheist. So I was an atheist before I became any kind of directly democratic person. But when I did the research, I found that a lot of Black people had gone to Canada during the Revolutionary War. I was in a dilemma because they were fighting for the side of the British. And then I had to realize that the American Revolution was perceived by them as being antithetical to freedom. And I couldn't reconcile that in my mind, but I knew that I had to leave here because I wasn't going to fight the war. Now, when I got up there, there's another moment, you know, there was this guy named Denfield Grant, Dominican. He's from Dominica. He was, he had gotten some kind of religious scholarship out west in Canada, but he said he couldn't, there's too much racism out there, too many white people, just culturally alienated, so he moved to Halifax. And I met him in the YMCA. He was making a living being a salesman, an encyclopedia salesman. Now these people, Dalhousie has given me some money. They'd given me about $800 or $900. And when I was to show up with my degree in hand or get into the program, they were going to give me installments along the way. But I couldn't get to Howard University to write a letter. I got Hicks. He wrote a letter, but that wasn't enough because he wasn't even chair of the department, you know. So here I am in Canada, and I'm with Denfield Grant, and we going out to this place called New Road at the point. It looked like an Indian reservation. I think it's called Preston now. Went out to New Road, and there was this Black guy. He had a house, a hut, really, on top of the hill. And the house didn't even have, this is the dead of winter by the snow on the ground all outside. He didn't even have no floor in his abode, you know. It was just packed down dirt. And we were sitting gathered around a potbelly stove and sitting on Coca-Cola crates. Nice guy. He wanted to get them encyclopedias for his children because he wanted his children to be educated and everything. But he was the closest thing to a peasant I ever seen in my life. And he lived among a whole bunch of other people living like that. Another dilemma is posed. Denny introduced me as a guy from Georgia. So he looked at me and he says, Mo is, I guess that's the Moorish Mo. Mo is Black, that's for Black people. Poor Mo catching hell down there. I said, yeah. So then I realized that this guy's pitying me and I'm pitying him. And we're two Black people up in Canada with snow on the ground outside pitying one another. Then I'm realizing that something's wrong here. Is it that Black people are innately ignorant and dumb or what? Then something must be. But these people were resourceful. And then I reflected on the people that I grew up with. I mean, they were smarter than the white people, really. The white people were the dummies. And then I began to realize there must be something systematically wrong. And at the same time, I got a job down it's supposed to have been a stopgap job in the dockyard. At that same time, the Russians had just consummated a wheat deal with the Canadians, and the Canadians were neutral in the war. So every once in a while, I would see a group of Russians in the bars up and down near the shipyard. And I started talking to a couple of them, and one of them gave me a Russian version of What Is to Be Done by Lenin. It was in Russian. I couldn't read it. But I had enough affiliation with the school, the university there, to go out and try to get it translated. And that's why I got in touch with the Russian Revolution. And I used to sneak in a class in Russian because I got some of my notes in Russian in the shed outside here. I was trying to actually learn Russian, and I learned to read a little bit of it, you know. So then I realized that my education had to, at worst it was just a brainwashing, and at best it was had to be critiqued. And also too, just so you know, there was a reflection. There was a young lady that I met when I was working at that summer in upstate New York, named Jean Dix. So that was my girlfriend that summer. She came down to, she was a reader. And also she was a student at the Philadelphia Museum School of Art. And she turned me on to Khalil Gibran and some of the, you know, idealistic poet writers during that time. I picked up Che somewhere. I can't remember where I got Che from. But these are the books that I was reading. That's the stuff I was reading.
And it's also, you know, you're engaged with, you know, some folk from the Caribbean, you know, in this
from area. The Caribbean, yeah.
You're working on the docks. And this is this is a very, very, this is like almost like a university within itself.
Yeah, it was.
You know.
And then Rocky Jones was my drinking partner at the bars. And he was local, so he would give me some local, and he'd hang out. They started what they call the peace movement was picking up, even in Canada. There was an organization called SOBU, the Student Union for Peace Action. They had a little local chapter there in Halifax. And then they started developing this community house it was a community center for Black kids where they could play basketball and they could, you know, it's just a community center. And I wasn't associated with it directly, but I would go by and hang out. I played basketball with the guys sometimes.
And so you're there for about a few years because you are.
No, just 1 year. Let me just 1 year. Because by that spring, I couldn't get a job on the shipyard no more. Mm. And I went and said, what? Mm. The St. Lawrence Seaway, which was frozen, had thawed out. And so they were getting the wheat from upstream, up there in Montreal and up to St. Lawrence Seaway. Hmm. I mean, so the circumstances, I just trying to understand what was happening to me. You know, I felt being like I was being batted about, but I understood that the world was like that, you know. And so I went up to Montreal and I worked for a month or so up there. And then I went to Detroit.
Let's pause real quick. In Montreal, what year was this? Was this around
66?
Okay.
No, 67, because the World Fair was there then.
And so this was the year before that, the Writers' Festival that was happening there.
I didn't know those guys then. Yeah. I didn't know that.
So being there in 67.
And when was that?
I believe it was 68. It was the next year.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, I was at Langston by then. I was in Halifax from 65 to 66.
Okay.
Then I went to Detroit in the summer of 66 because it was the year before the rebellion. And then I stayed in my aunt's basement because I was really paranoid. Well, I wasn't paranoid. They were looking for me. I know that. But the computers couldn't catch me. So I stayed in my aunt's basement. But I was working at Stroh's Brewery in the summer of 66. No, wait a minute, 66. Yeah, the summer of 66. That's where I met Charles Simmons. Yeah. We just returned from the Vince Remus stuff. And they were friends of Cuba at the time.
So you're there in 66. And how long
summer,
you were in
summer.
The summer of 66 and you leave?
Oh, just about 4 months. And he was there too. In the summer, the brewery hires a bunch of superfluous, labor because people drink more beer during the summer. So I was there working in the brewery.
It was advantageous for you at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. So free beer too.
Right. So you leave Detroit. You're there for a few
months. And go back up to Canada.
You go back up to Canada.
Because okay. I needed some money. I was okay. running out of money.
Okay.
Then I got married and went back up to London, Ontario, and stayed in London from September until after the World's Fair. World's Fair was 67. Mm-hmm. So I was at the World's Fair in 67. I stayed in the summer, part of the summer of 67, I stayed in, with some squatters in Montreal that are abandoned. But we had it organized. Me and my young wife, we had a little old space there. We had to cook. I mean, people living in a commune together. Mm-hmm. I never experienced that before. So I stayed there. I went up to the World's Fair, and I stayed there for a couple of months in that commune. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I went to Langston.
And Langston's in Tennessee?
Oklahoma.
That's right. Langston, Oklahoma.
Yeah, yeah. In the middle of Oklahoma, wasn't nobody going to find us there.
Yeah, because you're still
I'm still 1A.
Yeah, right. They're looking for
1A. So they okay. I had the letter. My girlfriend had the letter. The greetings letter. I should have kept that. Letter. The greetings letter.
Yeah.
Greetings. You know.
Yeah.
You've been drafted into the United States Army.
You know? And that's how they open the greetings as you know. Yeah. How was your day?
You're listening to a portion of part one of a four-part series where we explore direct democracy, autonomy, maroonage, black anarchism, and atheism with Modibo Kadale. Dr. Modibo Kadale is a social ecologist, academic, and lifelong radical activist within the civil rights, black power, and Pan-Africanist movements, and the founding convener of the Autonomous Research Institute for Direct Democracy and Social Ecology. The music in the background is Bridge Through Time by Lonnie Liston Smith, and we play that commemorating his birthday, which was December 28. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW, 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
So you're there in Oklahoma. You know, how long are you in Oklahoma?
I was in Oklahoma for 67, the academic years of 2 years, so 67, 68, 68, 69, June 69, I was back in Detroit.
Okay. And then let's pick up.
I had the Guardian newspaper that in Langston, the librarian's name was Laron Clark. He would give me any book I wanted. Mm-hmm. Any book I wanted. He had a little space in the library, like the stacks. Mm-hmm. You know, he had a little place in the library. And sometimes I'd go in there, you know, he'd put some stuff up there that I hadn't seen. He'd come back and said, see, take a look at this. That's what I'm read Oliver Nkrumah's stuff. Mm. I read Marlana Karanga's. He had a couple of things out there. Mm. And what else was I reading? Of course, Franz Fanon. Mm-hmm. That took me out of way. And of course, Malcolm X's autobiography and stuff. Mm-hmm. And those are stuff, that kind of stuff I was reading. Mm-hmm. Negritude stuff like that.
Okay.
But I had, on top of that, I had already been acquainted with Lenin and Che. I mean, there was some. I had an international perspective. Mm. It wasn't just a Black Power in the United States perspective. And I started reading Amir Sinclair, mm-hmm. Negritude stuff in France, Jean-Paul Sartre. What else? That's the stuff I was reading then.
Yeah, no, and I know that led to a whole range of things. This is happening, you know, again, as you're reading, you're developing.
And then of course the Guardian is coming out, and New Guardian is coming out, and all kind of newspapers are coming out, and he got them for me too. I'm very grateful to him for that.
Just to be clear, these are black.
Black guy.
He later became the development officer
at Hampton. I think he retired from there. I don't know if he's still living or not, but he was the director of libraries at Langston.
So you're in Langston, and then you go to Detroit. And describe Detroit, because Detroit, you know, during this particular time.
This is my second visit to Detroit.
Right. So you go back there, and what's happening?
Well, the reason I went back there is because I saw the Dodge strike. I read about the Dodge main strike in the Guardian magazine. I mean, the Guardian newspaper, and they had nice pictures in there. I read that thing back and forward. And by that time, Charles Simmons, who I had met that summer, strangely enough, I don't know if I was following him around or he was following me around. He was from Detroit. He had been a student at Wayne, and he wanted to get away from Detroit. So he ended up in Langston a year before I did. And he graduated a year before I came back. So he was my contact in Detroit.
That's interesting.
So he later, if you know, he was the international correspondent for the Muhammad Speaks for many years. Mm-hmm. Charles Simmons, you can see his byline all over.
So let's talk about when you go back. You know, you're looking at you're looking at Drum. You're looking at, you know, these things that are happening. Rebellion had happened. You know, talk about that particular period, because this is also where you were Kamathi Muhammad, C.L.R. James, Face of Reality. Mm-hmm. All of this, there's things going on, and you move into this space. Yeah.
Well, I got a job at Highland Park Community College right after I left Langston. And I was married. My wife and I'm beginning to move in a direction where she can't go. You know, I read anything came out of Africa. I became an Africanist because all these independent movements were taking place in Africa, all kind of stuff. You know? And of course, Nkrumah was at the head of all of that. So I read everything that mentioned Nkrumah. Got to Detroit, I knew that the Drum was formed. There was no league yet, just Drum, because it was the summer. Got in contact with Charles. Charles took me over to what became the league headquarters, and I met General Baker. I was very impressed with him as a human being. He was an amiable, nice guy, but he was resolute in what he believed. You know, people respected him. He's a big, you know, he could be, you knew that this guy, whatever he said, you know, he wasn't going to let you down. You know what I mean? You know, he'd have your back, boy. I don't know how he achieved that kind of magnetism. So we became friends, you know. General Gordon Baker. Later found out that General Gordon Baker and my great-grandfather, his great-grandfather were in a land dispute in Hancock County, Georgia. And his grandfather got all the land. My grandfather became penniless. But anyway, that was later on. But General Baker was there. There was a split between the cultural nationalists in Detroit and the Marxists. And that was an early split. Because I had a dashiki when I got on. General Baker said, well, you can't wear that on the street, man, because people might misunderstand. So me and Charles took off our dashiki right there in the office. Yeah. I just talked to Charles yesterday, man. He's doing all right. He's gonna be down here this summer sometime.
Oh, good. So talk a little bit more about the, you know, this environment. So yes, you know, the split comes up, but this all, you know, that split between, you know, the Marxists, cultural nationalists, that's something that's happening across
all over. All over.
Detroit is very interesting in multiple particular ways because of the, you know, a lot of folk who come out of that particular kind of move against these hierarchical structures. They're really, it was a very interesting period. Could you contextualize a little bit more that led up to the split? Yeah, just talk. Yeah, please.
In 1967, you know, the rebellion took place, a hell of a rebellion. In 1968, there was another rebellion in the wake of Martin Luther King's assassination. All kind of organizations were developing. The Shrine of the Black Madonna, they had just painted the Madonna black. The Nation of Islam, who had been there for a good little while, and they were entrenched. The Black Panthers was there. They were recruiting some younger people. The student movement was beginning to develop Black studies in all of the schools. Wayne State, Highland Park College, which was where I was. And we had a long strike that following spring. The strike lasted for a whole month. And that's the first time policemen, you know, came down on me with some guns. Boy, that was awakening there. That was an awakening there too. And the league, with its unique perspective, was taking shape. The RNA, Republic of New Africa, they were strong. There was a shootout at the, I don't know whether it was the Shrine or where, but there was a shootout. So all of that action was taking place, had just taken place and was beginning to take place. All these different formations. But these organizations would coalesce around certain charismatic leaders and their followers. The followers didn't have a real understanding of their ideological perspective. All they wanted to know is that this guy here was real deal guy and we will follow him. You know? And so I found that kind of problematic. But General Baker, as we were developing the strike at Highland Park Community College, the league had just developed and it was right down the street from Highland Park. It was in Highland Park, right down the street from Highland Park Community College. General Baker came and we liberated a section of the campus, you know, and General was there. He slept with us and we did some education. He was right there with us, he and Chuck Wooten. But by that time, they were forming all kinds of rum organizations at all of the point of production places. The points of production was the emphasis of the league. But they were not quite clear because there were some different tactics on what to do. So I can take Drum, for instance. There was an election in the Dodge Main Plant, which was in Hamtramck, which was a sister city from Highland Park. And some of the guys wanted to run for office. Other guys wanted to have these stewards on the shop floor. Other guys wanted to hook up with the Black Panthers and set up, there's all kind of confusion going on there. In this process, we put out a film called Finally Got the News. That was a production of the League. The League opened a bookstore. They were all kind of bookstores. The old left had the Communist Party bookstore, the SWP bookstore, of course, Facing Reality bookstore, Shrine bookstore. They had bookstores. And me and my friend, Jalali Farrakhan, who was also a draft dodge, I met up with him. He was underground. We would be traveling in certain circles. He and I used to just downright steal books, man. We used to have a trench coat with lining in it for books. We just slide the book down. But Detroit was a hotbed. In the summer of 1968, man, Detroit was on fire. It was. And that momentum continued through the next year because there was a big demonstration downtown. All of these organizations were working together during that time. And then somehow it just started ebbing because organizations started becoming organized. And then people started developing democratically centralized leadership cadre, people trying to do different kinds of stuff, but the organization began to ebb, and we were trying to organize the league. I was on the central staff of the league, which was the executive board was the founding members of the organization, And they never did have an election or anything. And sometimes they were not in touch with what the organization was doing. And it was a very confusing time after a while. And then as time went on, they began to, faction started developing. There was the nationalist faction, the Marxist-Leninist faction, the cultural nationalist faction. The documents are pretty much, I tried to document some of it in this old raggedy book here, called Internationalism, Pan-Africanism, and the Struggle of Social Class. And chapter, I got a chapter in here on the League. Chapter 5 is entitled The League of Revolutionary Black Workers. Yeah, but next time I see you, I'm gonna have a copy of it, and then I'll just give it to you.
Okay. Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Yeah, I think I missed that. So factions are starting to develop, and this is coming out of the idea of the centralization or the structural process.
Structural process.
That really becomes, you know, I guess anti. Provide an assessment of that, like, you know, this whole process is the idea of organ, because most people think organization is a bureaucracy, right?
Yeah, this process. I outlined that there was a retreat that we had, and Ernie M. Kalimoto, Ernie Allen, he later became an academic over at UMass, and he presented a paper with a class analysis of the different factions in the League, and people took that personally, took it as if he was attacking them personally. And I had gone to Washington, D.C. To a meeting down there talking about getting some resources for the League. I came back, I found out I was purged. You know, they never even, what was happening is a lot of resources were coming in to the organization, and the organization never had a specific channel for all of the resources to be appropriated and everything. So it just got to be difficult, very, very difficult. I can talk to you specifically about the League, but it just wasn't clear ideologically where we were going. And I found out that a lot of organizations were having the same problem. The problem, the situation resulted and was worked out with factions coalescing around certain personalities and coalescing around these different personalities. And there's no meetings. The meetings were not being documented or any way recorded. And so people didn't know what was said from one meeting to another.
So it seems like, you know, again, this structuring process kind of took over, particularly around the personalities that were kind of leading, you know, these things.
And so in the process, me and some more people, we just trying to find our way through this morass too, because we were that clear. We knew that there was no elections being held. We knew that there was no way that the organization, that the election, the board, the executive board, was in touch with the lower level of the organization. It was just all kind of stuff in the middle. And so that's when I got in touch with CLR, that faction of CLR.
Can I pause you just one second?
Yeah.
I just want to just go back just a minute here. You know, you go down to D.C. and you're purged. You know, was there any type of, it was just, they were just going through a purge process?
No. What happened was I was also writing articles for the Inner City Voice, which is the League newspaper. Mm-hmm. So I called the editor and I said, well, I'm writing something on, on East Africa or something. And I told him it was ready. And he said, ready? I guess you haven't heard. I said, no, I've been out of town. He said, you've been purged. I said, well, who? So they purged me and my wife then. Ernie was purged. Anybody who had a voice that they looked at as being contrary to what the voice of the executive. In other words, you couldn't speak. You couldn't give forth an analysis of the League without it being approved by the executive committee. So it was, I was shocked. We'd already set up a community organizing cadre. So we just went on and kept working, you know. The PAC was there.
Talk a little bit more about, you know, this, that, and also in relation to you getting in touch with CLR James as well, like coming into contact. Could you talk about that cadre, that community cadre development?
Yeah, that community cadre developed out of the same people who came as a result of the Highland Park Community College strike for Black Studies. And in the meantime, I also taught, a year later, I taught at the University of Detroit. So there was some cadre there. We were struggling for curriculum changes in the Black Studies in at the University of Detroit. So we would meet on Sunday morning at 9 o'clock every Sunday morning. And we were a loose group of people. We call ourselves the PAC, the People's Action Committee. It's confusing because there was a cultural nationalist group called the Pan-Africanist Congress, which had a higher public profile than we did. But when we looked at the People's Action Committee, and I looked at what was going on with the mass movement, the People's Action Committee had more direct contact with community control issues, student strikes, even worker strikes, and all. Because Highland Park was a junior college. Highland Park Community College was a junior college where most of the workers, they were either workers in the plants or the children of workers in the plants. So it was rooted. It was rooted. And we were leaderless. We just met in the apartment downstairs from my house. You know, we were self-directed. Otherwise, we would read a book. And then the next time we would choose a book, or somebody wanted to come in and bring in somebody who had some issues with a school issue or any kind of issue. And then we had Walter Rodney came in. He was at the University of Michigan. And he came and spoke to us for a couple, two or three times. And that's how we got in touch. That's how we got in touch with the people who did the African Liberation Support Committee.
You've just been listening to a portion of part one of a four-part series where we explore direct democracy, autonomy, maroonage, black anarchism, and atheism with Modibo Kadale. Dr. Modibo Kadale is a social ecologist, academic, and lifelong radical activist within the civil rights, black power, and Pan-Africanist movements, and the founding convener of the Autonomous Research Institute for Direct Democracy and Social Ecology. You can visit African Now's SoundCloud page, that's African Now Online on SoundCloud, to hear the rest of part one of the four-part series. The music in the background is Insomnia by Mabel Liston, remembering her birthday, which is January 13. That's it for the first edition of Africa Now for 2025 today. I'm your host, Muiza Mtali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Sha'anana with Zain Al-Amin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, particularly spotlighting the plight of Palestinians. And that's followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by The Browder File with Tony Browder, which is followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, and that's followed by Combit La Caille with Eugenia Charles, which looks at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope, and to our engineers Michael Nasella and Kalia Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers Chanda Kozer and Funangonda, and the African World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Utterson. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave with a closing song entitled Purple Condor by Danilo Perez, commemorating his birthday, which was December 29th. Again, Happy New Year and stay safe.
WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, January 8th. Here are some headlines. At least two people were killed as a trio of fast-growing wildfires raged out of control today near Los Angeles, destroying hundreds of buildings, scorching hillsides, and prompting officials to order some 70,000 people to evacuate their homes. By early today, more than 5,600 acres of Los Angeles County had burned. The Palisades fire had burned over 3,000 acres and destroyed homes and businesses. Dozens of drivers abandoned their cars on Tuesday, as some chose to flee the flames on foot. The Eaton Fire near Pasadena is quickly increasing in size today amid dangerous high winds. California's governor is urging residents to heed the evacuation warnings that extend from Malibu to Santa Monica. Energy providers have begun shutting off power in high-risk areas to prevent damaged infrastructure from igniting more blazes. In other news, in an emergency application filed late yesterday, President-elect Donald Trump urged the U.S. Supreme Court to pause sentencing in his New York hush money case, which is set for Friday. Trump's emergency appeal arrived a day after a state appeals court in New York rejected his request to postpone the sentencing. Trump's emergency application asked the Supreme Court to prevent the prosecution until his appeals implicating presidential immunity are resolved. Trump argues that he is entitled to full immunity from prosecution and even sentencing now that he is president-elect. Mr. Trump's lawyers argued in the Supreme Court filing that being officially deemed a felon might complicate Donald Trump's presidential duties. And in Minneapolis, city leaders agreed Monday to a police accountability plan with the Justice Department that mandates extensive charges aimed at curbing excessive force and racial discrimination more than 4.5 years after the police killing of George Floyd led to nationwide protests. The legally binding consent decree marks a victory for the Biden administration in its efforts to use federal power to require local police departments to pursue broad changes. Under Attorney General Merrick Garland, the Justice Department has opened a dozen pattern or practice civil investigations into state or local law enforcement agencies. Minneapolis is the second jurisdiction to enter a consent agreement after Louisville last month. And Greenland may become independent if its residents want, but is unlikely to become a U.S. state, Denmark's foreign minister said today, after U.S. President-elect Donald Trump said he might take over the mineral-rich and strategically important island by force. Speaking to the press, Trump would not rule out using the military to acquire control of the Panama Canal and Greenland as he discussed his second-term agenda. Additionally, Trump said he could use economic force to turn Canada into the United States' 51st state and floated the idea of renaming the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America. Officials in Denmark and Greenland have reportedly said the island is not for sale.